scarcely aware of moving before he had the bulky man by the collar, hauling him to his feet, slamming him back against the wall.
"Don't you say that," he snarled. "Don't you ever say that."
The man blinked down at him in astonishment. He was a full head taller than Matt.
"Just a saying," somebody behind him was muttering. "Light, it's just a saying."
Matt released his grip on the scar-faced man's coat and backed away.
I don't like anybody saying things like that about me. I'm no dark friend.
Burn me. Not the dark one's luck. Not that.
Oh, Light, did that bloody dagger really do something to me?
Nobody said you was, the broken-nosed man muttered.
He seemed to be getting over his surprise and trying to decide whether to be angry. Gathering his belongings from where he had piled them behind him, Matt walked out of the tavern, leaving the coins where they lay. It was not that he was afraid of the big man. He had forgotten the man, and the coins, too. All he wanted was to be outside in fresh air where he could think. In the street, he leaned against the wall of the tavern not far from the door, breathing the coolness in. The dark streets of South Harbor were all but empty now. Music and laughter still floated from the inns and taverns, but few people made their way through the night. Holding the quarterstaff upright in front of him with both hands, he lowered his head to his fists and tried to think at the puzzle from every side. He knew he was lucky. He could remember always being lucky. But somehow his memories from Emmons Field did not show him as lucky as he had been since leaving. Certainly he had gotten away with a great deal, but he could remember also being caught in pranks he had been sure would succeed. His mother had always seemed to know what he was up to, and Nynaeve able to see through whatever defenses he put up. But it was not just since leaving the Two Rivers that he had become lucky. The luck had come once he took the dagger from Shadar Logoth. He remembered playing at dice back home with a sharp-eyed, skinny man who worked for a merchant come down from Bearlawn to buy tobacco. He remembered the strapping his father had given him, too, on learning Matt owed the man a silver mark and 4 pence.
"But I'm free of the bloody dagger," he mumbled. "Those bloody Aes Sedai said I was."
He wondered how much he had won tonight. When he dug into his coat pockets, he found them filled with loose coins. Crowns and marks, both silver and gold, that glittered and glinted in the light from nearby windows. He had 2 purses now, it seemed, and both fat. He undid the strings and found more gold. And still more stuffed in his belt pouch between and around and on top of his dice cups, crumpling Elaine's letter and the Ammerlin's paper. He had a memory of tossing silver pence to serving girls because they had pretty smiles or pretty eyes or pretty ankles, and because silver pence were not worth keeping.
Not worth keeping? Maybe they weren't. Light, I'm rich. I am bloody rich. Maybe it was something the Aes Sedai did. Something they did healing me. By accident, maybe. That could be it. Better than the other. Those bloody Aes Sedai must have done it to me.
A big man moved out from the tavern, the door already swinging shut to cut off the light that might have shown his face. Matt pressed his back close against the wall, stuffed the purses back into his coat, and firmed his grip on the quarterstaff. Whatever his luck tonight had come from, he did not mean to lose all that gold to a footpad. The man turned toward him, peered, then gave a start.
Cool night, he said drunkenly.
He staggered closer, and Matt saw that most of his size was fat.
I have to.
Stumbling, the fat man moved on up the street, talking to himself disjointedly.
Fool,
Matt muttered, but he was not sure whether he meant it for the fat man or for himself. Time to find a ship to take me away from here. He squinted at the black sky, trying to estimate how long till dawn. 2, maybe 3 hours, he thought.
Past time.
His stomach growled at him. He dimly recalled eating in some of the inns, but he did not remember what. The fever of the dice had had him by the throat. A hand pushed into the script found only crumbs.
Way past time. Or one of them will come pick me up with her fingers and stick me in her pouch.
He pushed away from the wall and started for the docks where the ships would be. At first he thought the faint sounds behind him were echoes of his boots on the cobblestones. Then he realized someone was following him. And trying to be stealthy.
Well, these are footpads, for sure.
Hefting the quarterstaff, he briefly considered turning to confront them. But it was dark and the footing on cobblestones uncertain, and he had no idea how many there were. Just because you did well against Gawain and Galad doesn't make you a bloody hero out of a story. He turned down a narrower, twisting side street, trying to walk on tiptoe and move quickly at the same time. Every window was dark here, and most shuttered. He was almost to the end when he saw movement ahead. Two men peering into the side street from where it led out onto another. And he heard slow footsteps behind him, soft scrapes of boot leather on stone. In an instant, he ducked into the shadowy corner where one building stuck out further than the next. It seemed the best he could do for the moment. Gripping the quarterstaff nervously, he waited. A man appeared from back the way he had come, crouching as he eased himself ahead one slow step at a time. And then another man. Each carried a knife in his hand and moved as if stalking. Matt tensed. If they came just a few steps closer before they noticed him hiding in the deeper shadows of the corner, he could take them by surprise. He wished his stomach would stop fluttering. Those knives were a great deal shorter than the practice swords, but they were steel, not wood. One of the men squinted toward the far end of the narrow street and suddenly straightened, shouting,
"Didn't he come your way, then?"
"I've seen nothing but the shadows," came the answer in a heavy accent. "I wish to be out of this. There are the strange things moving this night."
Not four paces from Matt, the two men exchanged looks, sheathed their knives, and trotted back the way they had come. He let out a long, slow breath.
Luck. Burn me if it's not good for more than dice.
He could no longer see the men at the mouth of the street, but he knew they were still out on the next street somewhere, and more behind him the other way. One of the buildings he was crouched against stood only a single story high here, and the roof looked flat enough. And a white stone frieze, carved in huge grape leaves, ran up the joining of the two buildings. Easing his quarterstaff up till one end rested on the edge of the roof, he gave it a hard shove. It landed with a clatter on the roof tiles. Not waiting to see if anyone had heard, he scrambled up the frieze, the big leaves giving easy toeholds even for a man in boots. In seconds, he had the staff back in hand and was trotting across the roof, trusting to luck for his footing. Three more times he climbed, each time gaining one story. The slightly sloping tiled roofs ran some distance at that level, and there was a breeze at that height, prickling the hair on the back of his neck with its chill, and almost making him think he was being followed.
"Stop that, fool. They're three streets away by now, looking for somebody else with a fat purse. And bad luck to them."
His boots slipped on the tiles, and he decided it might be a good idea to think about getting back down into the street himself. Cautiously, he moved to the edge of the roof and peered down. An empty street lay a good 40 feet or more below him, with three taverns and an inn spilling light and music onto the cobblestones. But off to his right was a stone bridge running from the top floor of his building to one on the other side. The bridge looked awfully narrow, running through darkness untouched by the tavern lights, arcing over a long fall to hard cobblestones. But he tossed the quarterstaff down and made himself follow before he could think about it too much. His boots thumped onto the bridge, and he let himself roll the way he had as a boy falling out of a tree. He fetched up against the waist-high railing. "Bad habits pay off in the long run," he told himself, as he got to his feet and picked up the staff. The window at the other end of the bridge was tightly shuttered and lightless. He did not think whoever lived in there would appreciate a stranger appearing in the middle of the night. He could see lots of stonework, but if there was as much as a finger hold in the reach of the bridge, the night hid it. "Well, stranger or no stranger, inside I go." He turned from the railing and suddenly became aware of a man sharing the bridge with him. A man with a dagger in his hand. Matt grabbed at the hand as the knife darted toward his throat. He barely caught the fellow's wrist with his fingers, and then the quarterstaff between them tangled itself in his legs, tripping him to fall back against the railing, to fall half over it, pulling the other man on top of him. Balanced there on the small of his back, teetering with his assailant's bared teeth in his face, he was as aware of the long drop under his head as he was of the blade catching faint moonlight as it edged toward his throat. His finger grip on the man's wrist was slipping, and his other hand was caught with the quarterstaff between their bodies. Only seconds had passed since he first saw the man, and in seconds more, he was going to die with a knife in his throat.
"Time to toss the dice," he said.
He thought the other man looked confused for an instant, but an instant was all he had. With a heave of his legs, Matt flipped them both off into the empty air. For a stretched-out moment, he seemed to have no weight. Air whistled past his ears and ruffled his hair. He thought he heard the other man scream, or start to. The impact knocked all the air out of his lungs and made silver-black flecks dance across his blurring vision. When he could breathe again, and see, he realized he was lying on top of the man who had attacked him, his fall cushioned by the other's body.
"Luck," he whispered.
Slowly he climbed to his feet, cursing the bruise the quarterstaff had put across his ribs. He expected the other man to be dead. Not many could survive a 30-foot fall to cobblestones with another's weight on top of him. But what he had not expected was to see the fellow's dagger driven to the hilt into his own heart. Such an ordinary-looking man to have tried to kill him. Matt did not think he would even have noticed him in a crowded room.
"You had bad luck, fellow," he told the corpse shakily.
Suddenly, everything that had happened rushed back in on him. The footpads in the twisting street, the scramble over the rooftops, this fellow, the fall. His eyes rose to the bridge overhead, and a fit of trembling hit him.
"I must have been crazy. A little adventure is one thing, but Rogosh Eagle Eye wouldn't ask for this."
He realized he was standing over a dead man with a dagger in his chest, just waiting for someone to come along and run shouting for city guards with the flame of Tarvalin on their chests. The Ammerlin's paper might get him away from them, but maybe not before she found out. He could still end up back in the White Tower without that paper, and possibly not even allowed outside the tower grounds. He knew he should be on his way to the docks right then, and on the first vessel sailing, if it was a rotten tub full of old fish, but his knees were shaking hard enough in reaction that he could hardly walk. And what he wanted was to sit down for just a minute. Just a minute to steady his knees. And then he was headed for the docks. The taverns were closer, but he started toward the inn. The common room of an inn was a friendly place where a man could rest a minute and not worry about who might be sneaking up behind him. Enough light came out through the windows for him to make out the sign. A woman with her hair in braids, holding what he thought was an olive branch and the words, "The Woman of Tanchico." Chapter 31. The Woman of Tanchico. The common room of the inn was brightly lit, the tables not near a quarter full so late. A few white-aproned serving women with mugs of ale or wine passed among the men, and a low murmur of talk ran under the sound of a harp being strummed and plucked. The patrons, some with pipes clenched in their teeth and one pair hunched over a stones board, had the look of ship's officers and minor merchants from the smaller houses, their coats well cut and of fine wool, but with none of the gold or silver or embroidery that richer men might have had. And for once there was no clack and rattle of dice to be heard. Fires blazed on the long hearths at the ends of the room, but even without those there would have been a warm feeling about the place. The harper stood on a tabletop reciting "Mara and the Three Foolish Kings" to the music of his harp. His instrument, all worked in gold and silver, was fit for a palace. Matt knew him. He had saved Matt's life once. The harper was a lean man, who would have been tall except for a stoop, and he moved with a limp when he shifted his footing on the tabletop. Even here inside, he wore his cloak, all covered with fluttering patches in 100 colors. He always wanted everyone to know he was a gleeman. His long mustaches and bushy eyebrows were as snow-white as the thick hair on his head, and his blue eyes held a look of sorrow as he recited. The look was as unexpected as the man. Matt had never known Tom Maryland to be a sorrowful man. He took a table, setting his things on the floor by his stool, and ordered two mugs. The pretty young serving girl's big brown eyes twinkled at him.
"Two, young master? You do not look such a hard-drinking man as that."
Her voice held a mischievous edge of laughter. After rummaging a bit, he brought out two silver pennies from his pocket. One more than paid for the wine, but he slipped her another for her eyes.
"My friend will be joining me."
He knew Tom had seen him. The old gleeman had nearly stopped the story dead when Matt came in. That was new, too. Few things startled Tom enough for him to let it show, and nothing short of Trollocs had ever made him stop a story in the middle that Matt knew. When the girl brought the wine and his coppers in change, he let the pewter mugs sit and listen to the end of the story.
"It was as we have said it should be," said King Maedl, trying to untangle a fish from his long beard.
Tom's voice seemed to almost echo inside a great hall, not an ordinary common room. His plucked harp sounded the three kings' final foolishness.
"It was as we said it would be," announced Orander. And feet slipping in the mud, he sat down with a great splash. "It was as we said it must be," proclaimed Kadar, as he searched up to his elbows in the river for his crown. "The woman knows not whereof she speaks. She is the fool." Madel and Orander agreed with him loudly, and with that, Mara had had enough. "I've given them all the chances they deserve, and more," she murmured to herself. Slipping Kadar's crown into her bag with the first two, she climbed back onto her cart, clucked to her mare, and drove straight back to her village. And when Mara had told them all that happened, the people of Heap would have no king at all.
He strummed the major theme of the king's foolishness once more, this time sliding to a crescendo that sounded even more like laughter, made a sweeping bow, and nearly fell off the table. Men laughed and stamped their feet, though likely every one of them had heard the story many times before, and called for more. The story of Mara was always well received, except perhaps by kings. Tom nearly fell again climbing down from the table, and he was more unsteady in his walk than a somewhat stiff leg could account for as he came to where Matt was sitting. Casually putting his harp on the table, he dropped onto a stool in front of the second mug and gave Matt a flat stare. His eyes had always been sharp as awls, but they seemed to be having trouble focusing.
"Common," he muttered.
His voice was still deep, but it no longer seemed to reverberate.
"The tale is 100 times better in plain chant and 1,000 in high, but they want common."
Without another word, he buried his face in his wine. Matt could not recall ever seeing Tom finish playing that harp without immediately putting it away in its hard leather case. He had never seen him the worse for drink. It was a relief to hear the gleeman complaining about his listeners. Tom never thought their standards were as high as his. At least something of him had not changed. The serving girl was back with no twinkle in her eyes. "Oh, Tom," she said softly, then rounded on Matt. "If I'd known he was the friend you awaited, I'd not have brought you wine for him if you give me 100 silver pence." "I did not know he was drunk," Matt protested. But her attention was back on Tom, her voice gentle again. "Tom, you need some rest. They'll keep you telling stories all night and all day if you let them." Another woman appeared on Tom's other side, lifting her apron off over her head. She was older than the first, but no less pretty. The two might have been sisters. "A beautiful story, I've always thought, Tom, and you tell it beautifully. Come, I've slipped a warming pan into your bed, and you can tell me all about the court in Camelin." Tom peered into the mug as if surprised to find it empty, then blew out his long mustaches and looked from one woman to the other.
"Pretty Maida, pretty Sal. Did I ever tell you that two pretty women have loved me in my life? That is more than most men can claim."
"You've told us all about it, Tom," the elder woman said sadly.
The younger glared at Matt as if this were all his fault.
"Two," Tom murmured. "Morgaze had a temper, but I thought I could ignore that. So it ended with her wanting to kill me. Dina, I killed, as good as. Not much difference. Two chances I've had, more than most, and I threw them both away."
"I will take care of him," Matt said.
Maida and Sal were both glaring at him now. He gave them his best smile, but it did not work. His stomach muttered loudly.
"Don't I smell chicken roasting? Bring me 3 or 4.
The two women blinked and exchanged startled looks when he added,
"Do you want something to eat too, Tom?"
"I could do with more of this fine Andoran wine."
The gleeman raised his cup hopefully.
No more wine for you tonight, Tom.
The older woman would have taken his cup if he had let her. Almost on top of the first woman, the younger said, in a mixture of firmness and pleading,
You'll have some chicken, Tom. It is very good.
Neither would leave until the gleeman agreed to eat something, and when they did go, they gave Matt such a combination of stares and sniffs that he could only shake his head.
Burn me. You would think I was encouraging him to drink more. Women.
But pretty eyes on the pair of them.
Rand said you were alive, he told Tom when Maida and Sal were out of hearing. Moraine always said she thought you were. But I heard you were in Kyrian, and meaning to go on to Tyr.
Rand is still well, then.
Tom's eyes sharpened to almost the keenness Matt remembered.
I'm not sure I expected that. Moraine is still with him, is she? A fine-looking woman. A fine woman, if she were not Aes Sedai. Meddle with that sort and you get more than your fingers burned.
Why wouldn't you expect Rand to be all right? Matt asked carefully. Do you know of something that could harm him?
No. I don't know anything, boy. I suspect more than is healthy for me, but I know nothing.
Matt abandoned that line of talk. No use firming his suspicions. No use letting him know I know more than's healthy myself. The older woman, Tom called her Maida, came back with three chickens with crisp brown skins, giving the white-haired man a worried look and Matt a warning one before she left. Matt ripped off a leg and set to as he talked. Tom frowned into his cup and never looked at the birds.
Why are you here in Tarvalen, Tom?
It's the last place I'd have expected to see you, the way you feel about Aes Sedai. I heard you were coining money in Kyrian.
Kyrian,
the old gleeman muttered, the sharpness fading from his eyes again.
Such trouble it causes killing a man, even when he deserves killing.
He made a flourish with one hand and was holding a knife. Tom always had knives secreted about him. Drunk he might have been, but he held the blade steady enough.
Kill a man who needs killing, and sometimes others pay for it. The question is, was it worth doing anyway? There's always a balance, you know. Good and evil, light and shadow. We would not be human if there wasn't a balance.
Put that away, Matt growled around a mouthful. I don't want to talk about killing. Light, that fellow is still lying right out there in the street. Burn me, I ought to be on a ship by now.
I just asked why you're in Tarvalen. If you had to leave Kyrian because you killed someone, I do not want to know about it. Blood and ashes, if you can't pull your wits out of the wine enough to talk straight, I'll leave now. With a sour look, Tom made the knife disappear.
Why am I in Tarvalen? I'm here because it is the worst place I could be, except maybe Camelin. It's what I deserve, boy. Some of the Red Adja still remember me. I saw Lyda in the street the other day. If she knew I was here, she would peel my hide off in strips, and then she would stop being pleasant.
I never knew you to feel sorry for yourself, Matt said disgustedly. Do you mean to drown yourself in wine?
What do you know of it, boy? Tom snarled. Put a few years on you, see something of life, maybe love a woman or two, and then you'll know. Perhaps you will if you have the brains to learn. Ah! You want to know why I'm in Tarvalen? Why are you in Tarvalen? I remember you shivering when you found out Moraine was Aes Sedai. You nearly soiled yourself every time anybody even mentioned the power. What are you doing in Tarvalen, with Aes Sedai on every side?
I am leaving Tarvalen. That's what I am doing here. Leaving.
Matt grimaced. The gleeman had saved his life, and maybe more. A fate had been involved. That was why Tom's right leg did not work as well as it should. There could not be enough wine on a ship to keep him this drunk.
I'm going to Camelin, Tom. If you need to risk your fool life for some reason, why not come with me?
Camelin, Tom said musingly.
Camelin, Tom. Elida will be likely going back there sooner or later, so you'd have her to worry about. And from what I remember, if Morgaze puts her hands on you, you'll wish Elida had you.
Camelin. Yes. Camlin would fit my mood like a glove.
The gleeman glanced at the chicken platter and gave a start.
What did you do, boy? Stuff them up your sleeve?
There was nothing left of the three birds but bones and carcasses with only a few strips of flesh remaining. Sometimes I get hungry, Matt muttered. It was an effort not to lick his fingers. Are you coming with me or not?
Oh, I will come, boy.
As Tom pushed himself to his feet, he did not seem as unsteady as he had been.
You wait here, and try not to eat the table, while I get my things and say some goodbyes.
He limped away, not staggering once. Matt drank a little of his wine and stripped off a few shreds that were left on the chicken carcasses, wondering if he had time to order another, but Tom was back quickly. His harp and flute in their dark leather cases hung on his back with a tied blanket roll. He carried a plain walking staff as tall as he was. The two serving women followed on either side. Matt decided they were sisters. Identical big brown eyes looked up at the gleeman with identical expressions. Tom was kissing first Saul, then Maida, and patting cheeks as he headed for the door, jerking his head for Matt to follow. He was outside before Matt could finish collecting his own belongings and pick up his quarterstaff. The younger of the two women, Saul, stopped Matt as he reached the door.
Whatever you said to him, I forgive you for the wine, even if it is taking him away. I've not seen him this alive in weeks.
She pressed something into his hand, and when he glanced at it, his eyes widened in confusion. She had given him a silver Tarvalin mark.
For whatever it was you said. Besides, whoever is feeding you is not doing a good job of it. But you still have pretty eyes.
She laughed at the expression on his face. Matt was laughing, too, in spite of himself, as he went out into the street, rolling the silver coin across the backs of his fingers.
So I have pretty eyes, do I?
His laughter shut off like the last drip from a wine barrel. Tom was there, but not the corpse. The windows of the taverns down the street put enough light across the cobblestones for him to be sure of it. The city guard would not have carried a dead man away without asking questions at those taverns and at the woman of Tanchico, too.
What are you staring at, boy?
Tom asked.
No Trollocs in those shadows.
Footpads, Matt muttered. I was thinking about footpads.
No street thieves or strong arms in Tarvalin either, boy. When the guards take a footpad, not that many try that game here, the word spreads. But when they do, they haul him to the tower. And whatever it is the Aes Sedai do to him, the fellow leaves Tarvalin the next day as wide-eyed as a goosed girl. I understand they're even harder on women caught thieving. No, the only way you'll have your money stolen here is somebody selling you polished brass for gold or using shaved dice. There are no footpads.
Matt turned on his heel and strode past Tom, heading toward the docks, quarterstaff thumping off the cobblestones, as if he could push himself ahead faster.
We're going to be on the first ship sailing, whatever it is. The first, Tom.
Tom's stick clicked hurriedly after him.
Slow down, boy. What's your hurry? There are plenty of ships sailing day and night. Slow down. There aren't any footpads.
The first bloody ship, Tom. If it's sinking, we'll be on it.
If they weren't footpads, what were they? They had to be thieves. What else could they be? Chapter 32. The First Ship. South Harbor itself, the great Ogier-made basin, was huge and round, surrounded by high walls of the same silver-streaked white stone as the rest of Tarvalin. One long wharf, most of it roofed, ran all the way around, except where the wide water gates stood open to give access to the river. Vessels of every size lined the wharf, most moored by the stern, and despite the hour, dockmen in coarse, sleeveless shirts hurried about loading and unloading bales and chests, crates and barrels, with ropes and booms or onto their backs. Lamps hanging from the roof beams lit the wharfs and made a band of light around the black water in the middle of the harbor. Small open boats scuttled through the darkness, the square lanterns atop their tall sternposts making it seem as if fireflies skittered across the harbor. They were small only compared to the ships, though. Some had as many as 6 pairs of long oars. When Matt led a still muttering Tom under an arch of polished redstone and down broad steps to the wharf, crewmen on one 3-masted ship were unfastening the mooring lines not 20 paces away. The vessel was larger than most Matt could see, between 15 and 20 spans from sharp bow to squared stern, with a flat, railed deck almost level with the wharf. The most important thing was that it was casting off. The first ship that sails. A gray-haired man came up the wharf. Three lines of hemp rope, sewn down the sleeves of his dark coat, marked him as a dockmaster. His wide shoulders suggested that he might have begun as a dockman hauling rope instead of wearing it. He glanced casually in Matt's direction and stopped, surprise on his leathery face.
"Your bundles say what you're planning, lad, but you might as well forget it. The sister showed me a drawing of you. You'll board no ship in South Harbor, lad. Go back up those stairs so I don't have to tell a man off to watch you."
"What under the light?"
Tom murmured. "That's all changed," Matt said firmly. The ship was casting off the last mooring line. The furled triangular sails still made thick, pale bundles in the long, slanted booms, but men were readying the sweeps. He pulled the Ammerlin's paper out of his pouch and thrust it in the dockmaster's face. "As you can see, I'm on the business of the tower, at the order of the Ammerlin Seat herself, and I have to leave on that very vessel there." The dockmaster read the words, then read them again.
"I never saw such a thing in my life.
Why would the tower say you couldn't go, then give you that?"
"Ask the Ammerlin if you want,"
Matt told him in a weary voice that said he did not think anyone could possibly be stupid enough to do that.
"But she'll have my hide and yours if I do not sail on that ship."
"You'll never make it," the dockmaster said, but he was already cupping his hands to his mouth. "Aboard the Grey Gull there! Stop! The light burn you, stop!"
The shirtless fellow at the tiller looked back, then spoke to a tall companion in a dark coat with puffy sleeves. The tall man never took his eyes off the crewman, just dipping the sweeps into the water.
"Give way together,"
he called, and the sweep blades curled up froth.
"I'll make it," Matt snapped. "The first ship," I said, "and the first ship I meant. Come on, Tom."
Without waiting to see if the gleeman followed, he ran down the wharf, dodging around men in barrows stacked with cargo. The gap between the Grey Gull's stern and the wharf widened as the sweeps bit deeper. Hefting his quarterstaff, he hurled it ahead of him toward the ship like a spear, took one more step, and jumped as hard as he could. The dark water passing beneath his feet looked icy, but in a heartbeat he had cleared the ship's rail and was rolling across the deck. As he scrambled to his feet, he heard a grunt and a curse behind him. Tom Marilyn hoisted himself up on the railing with another curse and climbed over onto the deck.
"I lost my stick," he muttered. "I'll want another."
Rubbing his right leg, he peered down at the still widening strip of water behind the vessel and shivered.
"I had a bath today already."
The shirtless steersman stared wide-eyed from him to Matt and back again, clutching the tiller as if wondering whether he could use it to defend himself from madmen. The tall man seemed nearly as stunned. His pale blue eyes bulged and his mouth worked soundlessly for a moment. His dark beard, cut to a point, seemed to quiver with rage, and his narrow face grew purple.
"By the stone," he bellowed finally. "What is the meaning of this? I've no room on this vessel for as much as a ship's cat, and I'd not take vagabonds who leap onto my decks if I did. Sonar, Vasa, heave this rubbish over the side."
Two extremely large men, barefoot and stripped to the waist, straightened from coiling lines and started toward the stern. The men at the sweeps continued their work, bending to lift the blades, taking three long steps along the deck, then straightening and walking backwards, hauling the ship ahead on their blades. Matt waved the Ammerlin's paper toward the bearded man, the captain, he supposed, with one hand, and fished a gold crown out of his pouch with the other, taking care, even in his haste, that the fellow saw that there were more where that came from. Tossing the heavy coin to the man, he spoke quickly, still waving the paper.
"For the inconvenience of our boarding as we did, Captain. More to come for passage. On business of the White Tower. Personal command of the Ammerlin Seat. Imperative we sail immediately. To Arengil in Andor. Utmost urgency. The blessings of the White Tower on all who aid us. The Tower's wrath on any who impede us."
Certain the man had seen the flame of Tarvalin seal by that time, and little more, Matt hoped, he folded the paper again and thrust it back out of sight, eyeing the two big men uneasily as they came up on either side of the captain. Burn me, they both have arms like Perrin's. He wished he had his quarterstaff in hand. He could see it lying where it had landed, further down the deck. He tried to look sure and confident, the sort of man others had better not trifle with, a man with the power of the White Tower behind him.
A long way behind me, I hope.
The captain looked at Matt doubtfully, and even more so at Tom in his gleeman's cloak, and none too steady a foot. But he motioned Sanor and Vasa to stop where they were.
I would not anger the tower. Burn my soul, for the time being the river trade takes me from Tyr to this den of... I come too often to anger anyone.
A tight smile appeared on his face.
But I spoke the truth. By the stone I did. 6 cabins I have for passengers, and all full. You could sleep on deck and eat with the crew for another gold crown, each. That is ridiculous, Tom snapped. I don't care what the war has done downriver. That is ridiculous.
The 2 large sailors shifted their bare feet.
It is the price, the captain said firmly. I do not want to anger anyone, but I'd as soon not have any business you can be on aboard my vessel. Like letting a man pay you so he can coat you with hot tar, mixing in that business. You pay the price, or you go over to the side, and the Amaranth's seat herself can dry you off. And I'll keep this for the trouble you've given me, thank you.
He stuffed the gold crown Matt had tossed him into a pocket of his puffy-sleeved coat.
How much for one of the cabins? Matt asked. 2 ourselves. You can put whoever is in it now with someone else.
He did not want to sleep out in the cold night.
And if you don't overwhelm a fellow like this, he'll steal your breeches and say he is doing you a favor.
His stomach rumbled loudly.
And we eat what you eat, not with the crew, and plenty of it.
Matt, Tom said. I'm the one who is supposed to be drunk here.
He turned to the captain, flourishing his patch-covered cloak as well as he could with blanket roll and instrument cases hung about him.
As you may have noticed, Captain, I am a gleeman.
Even in the open air, his voice suddenly seemed to echo.
For the price of our passages, I would be more than glad to entertain your passengers and your crew.
My crew is aboard to work, gleeman, not be entertained.
The captain stroked his pointed beard. His pale eyes priced Matt's plain coat to the copper.
So you want a cabin, do you?
He barked a laugh.
And my meals? Well, you can have my cabin and my meals. For 5 gold crowns from each of you. Ander in weight.
Those were the heaviest. He began to laugh so hard his words came out in wheezes. Flanking him, Sanor and Vasa grinned wide grins.
For 10 crowns, you can take my cabin and my meals, and I'll move in with the passengers and eat with the crew. Burn my soul, I will. By the stone, I swear it. For 10 gold crowns.
Laughter choked off anything else. He was still laughing and gasping for breath and wiping tears from his eyes when Matt pulled out one of his 2 purses, but laughter stopped by the time Matt had counted 5 crowns into his hands. The captain blinked in disbelief. The 2 big crewmen looked pole-axed.
Ander in weight, you said?
Matt asked. It was hard to judge without scales, but he laid 7 more on the pile. 2 actually were Anderin, and he thought the others made up the weight.
Close enough for this fellow.
After a moment, he added another 2 gold Tyran crowns. For whoever you'll be pushing out of the cabin, they paid for. He did not think the passengers would see a copper of it, but it sometimes paid to appear generous.
Unless you mean to share with them.
No, of course not. They ought to have something for having to crowd in with others.
There's no need for you to eat with your crew, Captain. You are welcome to share Tom's meals and mine in your cabin.
Tom stared at him as hard as the others did.
Are you...
The bearded man's voice was a hoarse whisper.
Are you, by any chance, a young lord in disguise?
I am no lord,
Matt laughed. He had reason to laugh. The Grey Gull was well out into the darkness of the harbor now, with the wharf a band of light pointing up the black gap, not far ahead now, where the water gates led out onto the river. The sweeps drove the vessel toward that gap quickly. Men were already swinging the long, slanting booms around, preparatory to unlashing the sails. And with gold in his hands, the captain no longer seemed ready to throw anyone overboard.
If you don't mind, Captain, could we see our cabin? Your cabin, I mean. It's late, and I, for one, want a few hours' sleep.
His stomach spoke to him.
And supper.
As the vessel put its bow into the blackness, the bearded man himself led the way down a ladder to a short, narrow passage, lined with doors set close together. While the captain cleared his things from his cabin, it ran the width of the stern, with its bed and all of its furnishings built into the walls, except two chairs and a few chests, and saw that Matt and Tom were settled, Matt learned a great deal, beginning with the fact that the man would not be pushing any passengers out of their quarters. He had too much respect for the coin they had paid, if not for them, to allow that. The captain would take his first cabin, and that officer would take the second's bed, pushing each lower man down till the deck master would end sleeping up in the bow with the crew. Matt did not think that information could be very useful, but he listened to everything the man said. It was always best to know not only where you were going, but who you were dealing with, or they might just take your coat and boots and leave you to walk home through the rain in bare feet. The captain was a tyrant named Juan Malia, and he spoke with great volubility once he had worked out Matt and Tom to his own satisfaction. He was not nobly born, he said, not him, but he would not have anyone think he was a fool. A young man with more gold than any young man should have by right might be a thief, if everyone did not know thieves never escaped Tarvalin with their haul. A young man dressed like a farm boy, but with the air and confidence of the lord he denied being? By the stone, I'll not say you are, if you say you are not. Malia winked and chuckled and tugged the point of his beard. A young man carrying a paper bearing the Ammerlin's seal and bound for Andor. There was no secret that Queen Morgaze had visited Tarvalin, though her reason certainly was. It was obvious to Malia something was afoot between Camelin and Tarvalin. And Matt and Tom were messengers, for Morgaze, he thought, by Matt's accent. Anything he could do to help in so great an enterprise would be his pleasure, not that he meant to poke where he was not wanted. Matt exchanged startled looks with Tom, who was stowing his instrument cases under a table built out from one wall. The room had two small windows on either side and a pair of lamps in jointed brackets for light. That's nonsense, Matt said. Of course, Malia replied. He straightened from pulling clothes out of a chest at the foot of the bed and smiled. Of course. A cupboard in the wall seemed to hold charts of the river he would need. I'll say no more. But he did mean to poke, though he attempted to disguise it, and he rambled while he tried to pry. Matt listened and answered the questions with grunts or shrugs or a word or two, while Tom said less than that. The gleeman kept shaking his head while unburdening himself of his possessions. Malia had been a riverman all his life, though he dreamed of sailing on the sea. He hardly spoke of a country besides Tyr without contempt. Andor was the only one to escape, and the praise he finally managed was grudging despite his obvious efforts. Good horses in Andor, I've heard. Not bad. Not as good as Tyrion's stock, but good enough. You make good steel and iron goods, bronze and copper. I've traded for them often enough, though you charge a weighty price. But then you have those mines in the Mountains of Mist. Gold mines, too. We have to earn our gold in Tyr. Mayenne received his greatest contempt. Even less a country than Mirandi is. One city and a few leagues of land. They underprice the oil from our good Tyran olives just because their ships know how to find the oilfish shoals. They've no right to be a country at all. He hated Ilion. One day we'll loot Ilion bare, tear down every town and village, and sow their filthy ground with salt. Malia's beard almost bristled with outrage at how filthy the Ilion land was. Even their olives are putrid. One day we'll carry every last Ilioner pig off in chains. That is what the High Lord Saman says. Matt wondered what the man thought Tyr would do with all those people if they actually fulfilled this scheme. The Ilioners would have to be fed, and they would surely do no work in chains. It made no sense to him, but Malia's eyes shone when he spoke of it. Only fools let themselves be ruled by a king or a queen, by one man or woman. Except Queen Morgaze, of course, he put in hastily. She is a fine woman, so I've heard. Beautiful, I'm told. All those fools bowing to one fool. The High Lords ruled Tyr together, reaching decisions in concert, and that was how things should be. The High Lords knew what was right and good and true, especially the High Lord Saman. No man could go wrong obeying the High Lords, especially the High Lord Saman. Beyond kings and queens, beyond even Ilion, lay a bigger hatred Malia attempted to keep hidden, But he talked so much in trying to find out what they were up to, and grew so carried away by the sound of his own voice, that he let more slip than he intended. They must travel a great deal serving a great queen like Morghese. They must have seen many lands. He dreamed of the sea because then he could see lands he had only heard of, because then he could find the Maenar oilfish shoals, could out-trade the sea folk and the filthy Ilioners. And the sea was far from Tarvalen. They must understand that, forced as they were to travel among odd places and people they could not have stomached if they were not serving Queen Morghese.
I never liked ducking there, never knowing who might be using the power.
He almost spat the last word. Since he had heard the High Lord Saman speak, though,
burn my soul, it makes me feel like hullworms are burrowing into my belly just looking at their white tower now, knowing what they plan.
The High Lord Saman said the Aes Sedai meant to rule the world. Saman said they meant to crush every nation, put their foot on every man's throat. Saman said Tyr could no longer hold the power out of its own lands, and believed that was enough. Saman said Tyr had its rightful day of glory coming, but Tarvalen stood between Tyr and glory.
There's no hope for it. Sooner or later they will have to be hunted down and killed, every last Aes Sedai. The High Lord Saman says the others might be saved, the young ones, the novices, the accepted, if they're brought to the stone. But the rest must be eradicated. That's what the High Lord Saman says. The White Tower must be destroyed.
For a moment, Malia stood in the middle of his cabin, arms full of clothes and books and rolled charts, hair almost brushing the deck beams overhead, staring at nothing with pale blue eyes, while the White Tower tumbled into ruin. Then he gave a start, as if realizing what he had just said. His pointed beard waggled uncertainly.
That is, that's what he says. I think that may be going too far myself. The High Lord Saman, he speaks so that he carries a man beyond his own beliefs. If Camelin can make covenants with the tower, why, so can Tyr.
He shivered and did not seem to know it.
That is what I say.
As you say, Matt told him, and felt mischief bubble inside. I think your suggestion is the right one, Captain, but don't stop with a few accepted, though. Ask a dozen Aes Sedai to come, or two. Think what the Stone of Tyr would be like with 24 Aes Sedai in it. Malia shuddered.
I will send a man for my money chest, he said stiffly, and stalked out.
Matt frowned at the closed door.
I think I shouldn't have said that.
I don't know why you might think that, Tom said dryly. Next, you could try telling the Lord Captain Commander of the White Cloaks he should marry the Amelin Seat.
His eyebrows drew down like white caterpillars.
High Lord Saman? I never heard of any High Lord Saman.
It was Matt's turn to be dry.
Well, even you cannot know everything about all the kings and queens and nobles there are, Tom. One or two might just have escaped your notice.
I know the names of the kings and queens, boy, and the names of all the High Lords of Tyr, too. I suppose they could have raised a High Lord of the land, but I'd think I would have heard of an old High Lord dying. If you had settled for booting some poor fellows out of their cabin instead of taking the captain's, we'd each have a bed to ourselves, narrow and hard as it might be. Now we have to share Malia's. I hope you don't snore, boy. I cannot abide snoring.
Matt ground his teeth. As he recalled, Tom had a snore like a wood rasp working on an oak knot. He had forgotten that. It was one of the two large men, Sanor or Vasa, he did not give his name, who came to pull the captain's iron-bound money chest from under the bed. He never said a word, only made sketchy bows, and frowned at them when he thought they were not looking, and left. Matt was beginning to wonder if the luck that had been with him all night had deserted him at last. He was going to have to put up with Tom snoring, and truth to tell, it might not have been the best luck in the world to jump onto this particular ship, waving a paper signed by the Amelin Seat and sealed with the flame of Tarvalen. On impulse, he pulled out one of his cylindrical leather dice cups, popped off the tight-fitting lid, and upended the dice onto the table. They were spotted dice, and 5 single pips stared up at him. The Dark One's Eyes, that was called in some games. It was a losing toss in those, a winning in other games. But what game am I playing? He scooped the dice up, tossed them again. 5 pips. Another toss, and again the Dark One's Eyes winked at him.
If you used those dice to win all that gold, Tom said quietly, no wonder you had to leave by the first ship sailing.
He had stripped down to his shirt and had that half over his head when he spoke. His knees were knobby, and his legs seemed all sinew and stringy muscle, the right a little shrunken.
Boy, a 12-year-old girl would cut your heart out if she knew you were using dice like that against her.
It isn't the dice, Matt muttered. It's the luck. Aes Sedai luck or the Dark One's luck?
He pushed the dice back into the cup and capped it. I suppose, Tom said, climbing into bed, you aren't going to tell me where all that gold came from, then?
I won it, tonight, with their dice.
Uh-huh. And I suppose you're not going to explain that paper you were waving around. I saw the seal, boy. Or all that talk about White Tower business, or why the dockmaster had your description from an Aes Sedai, either.
I am carrying a letter to Morghese from Elaine, Tom, Matt said, a good deal more patiently than he felt. Nynaeve gave me the paper. I don't know where she got it.
Well, if you are not going to tell me, I'm going to sleep. Blow out the lamps, will you?
Tom rolled on his side and pulled a pillow over his head.
Even after Matt had stripped off down to his small clothes and crawled under the blankets, after blowing out the lamps, he could not sleep, though Malia had done well by himself with a good feather mattress. He had been right about Tom snoring, and that pillow muffled nothing. It sounded as if Tom were cutting wood cross-grain with a rusty saw, and he could not stop thinking.
How had Nynaeve and Egwene and Elaine gotten that paper from the Ammerlin? They had to be involved with the Ammerlin Seat herself, in some plot, one of those White Tower machinations. But now that he thought about it, they had to be holding something back from the Ammerlin, too.
"Please carry a letter to my mother, Matt,"
he said softly in a high-pitched, mocking voice.
Fool! The Ammerlin would have sent a warder with any letter from the daughter heir to the queen. Blind fool, wanting to get out of the tower so bad I couldn't see it.
Tom's snore seemed to trumpet agreement.
Most of all, though, he thought about luck and footpads.
The first bump of something against the stern barely registered on him. He paid no attention to a thump and scuffle from the deck overhead or the tread of boots. The vessel itself made enough noises, and there had to be someone on deck for the ship to make its way downriver. But stealthy footsteps in the passageway leading to his door merged with thoughts of footpaths and made his ears prick up. He nudged Tom in the ribs with an elbow.
"Wake up," he said softly. "There's somebody outside in the hall."
He was already easing himself off the bed, hoping the cabin floor,
deck, floor, whatever it bloody is,
would not creak under his feet. Tom grunted, smacked his lips, and resumed snoring. There was no time to worry about Tom. The footsteps were right outside. Taking up his quarterstaff, Matt placed himself in front of the door and waited. The door swung open slowly, and 2 cloaked men, one behind the other, were faintly outlined by dim moonlight through the hatch at the top of the ladder they had crept down. The moonlight was enough to glint off bare knife blades. Both men gasped. They obviously had not expected to find anyone waiting for them. Matt thrust with the quarterstaff, catching the first man hard right under where his ribs joined together. He heard his father's voice as he struck.
"It's a killing blow, Matt. Don't ever use it unless it's your life."
But those knives made it for his life. There was no room in the cabin for swinging a staff. Even as the man made a choking sound and folded toward the deck, fighting vainly for breath, Matt stepped forward and drove the end of the quarterstaff over him into the second man's throat with a loud crunch. That fellow dropped his knife to clutch at his throat and fell on top of his companion, both of them scraping their boots across the deck, death rattles already sounding in their throats. Matt stood there, staring down at them.
"Two men. No, burn me, 3. I don't think I ever hurt another human being before, and now I've killed 3 in one night. Light.
Silence filled the dark passageway, and he heard the thump of boots on the deck overhead. The crewmen all went barefoot. Trying not to think about what he was doing, Matt ripped the cloak from one of the dead men and settled it around his shoulders, hiding the pale linen of his small clothes. On bare feet, he padded down the passage and climbed the ladder, barely sticking his eyes above the hatch coping. Pale moonlight reflected off the taut sails, but night still covered the deck with shadows, and there was no sound except the rush of water along the vessel's sides. Only one man at the tiller, the hood of his cloak pulled up against the chill, seemed to be on deck. The man shifted, and boot leather scuffed on the deck planks. Holding the quarterstaff low and hoping it would not be noticed, Matt climbed on up.
"He's dead," he muttered in a low, rough whisper. "I hope he squealed when you cut his throat."
The heavily accented voice was one Matt remembered, calling from the mouth of a twisting street in Tarvalen.
"This boy, he causes us too much of the trouble. Wait, who are you?"
Matt swung the staff with all his strength. The thick wood smashed into the man's head, the hood of his cloak only partly muffling a sound like a melon hitting the floor. The man fell across the tiller, shoving it over, and the vessel lurched, staggering Matt. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a shape rising out of the shadows by the railing, and the gleam of a blade, and he knew he would never get his staff around before it struck home. Something else that shone streaked through the night and merged with the dim shape with a dull thunk. The rising motion became a fall, and a man sprawled almost at Matt's feet. A babble of voices rose below decks as the ship swung again, the tiller shifting with the first man's weight. Tom limped from the hatch in cloak and small clothes, raising the shutter on a bull's-eye's lantern.
"You were lucky, boy. One of those below had this lantern. Could have set the ship on fire lying there."
The light showed a knife hilt sticking up from the chest of a man with dead, staring eyes. Matt had never seen him before. He was sure he would have remembered someone with that many scars on his face. Tom kicked a dagger away from the dead man's outflung hand, then bent to retrieve his own knife, wiping the blade on the corpse's cloak.
"Very lucky, boy. Very lucky indeed."
There was a rope tied to the stern rail. Tom stepped over to it, shining the lantern down astern, and Matt joined him. At the other end of the rope was one of the small boats from South Harbor, its square lantern extinguished. 2 more men stood among the pulled-in oars.
"The great Lord take me, it's him!"
one of them cried. The other darted forward to work frantically at the knot holding the rope.
"You want to kill these 2 as well?"
Tom asked, his voice booming as it did when he performed.
"No, Tom," Matt said quietly. "No."
The men in the boat must have heard the question and not the answer, for they abandoned the attempt to free their boat and leaped over the side with great splashes. The sound of them thrashing away across the river was loud.
"Fools," Tom muttered. "The river narrows somewhat after Tarvalen, but it must still be 1/2 mile or more wide here. They'll never make it in the dark."
"By the stone," came a shout from the hatch. "What happens here? There are dead men in the passageway. What's Vasa doing lying on the tiller? He'll run us onto a mud bank."
Naked save for linen underbreeches, Malia dashed to the tiller, hauling the dead man off roughly as he pulled the long lever to put the course straight again.
"That isn't Vasa. Burn my soul, who are all these dead men?"
Others were clambering on deck now, barefoot crewmen and frightened passengers wrapped in cloaks and blankets. Shielding his actions with his body, Tom slipped his knife under the rope and severed it in one stroke. The small boat began falling back into the darkness.
"River brigands, Captain," he said. "Young Matt and I have saved your vessel from river brigands. They might have cut everyone's throat if not for us. Perhaps you should reconsider your passage fee."
"Brigands!" Molly exclaimed. "There are plenty of those down around Carrion, but I never heard of it this far north."
The huddled passengers began to mutter about brigands and having their throats cut. Matt walked stiffly to the hatch. Behind him he heard Malia.
"He's a cold one. I never heard that Andor employed assassins,
But burn my soul, he is a cold one.
Matt stumbled down the ladder, stepped over the two bodies in the passage,